think it ain't nothing but the bear.
Cab Calloway and his band, as recorded in 1940. The bass player on that recording was Milt Hinton, and he'll be with us in just a couple of minutes. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we continue the series Alec Wilder and the American Popular Song. The guest singer today is Mary Mayo, and she'll discuss and perform songs by Vernon Duke, including I Can't Get Started and April in Paris. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be here at 3:30 with her weekly review of museum and gallery shows around town. She'll be reviewing the show of Milt Hinton's photographs of jazz musicians now on display at the Paul Kava Gallery. George Stoney is one of the pioneers of the community television and public access television movement. He's been making documentaries for social change since 1956. Stoney is in Philadelphia to speak at a conference on cable television and independent producers. He'll speak with us at about 3 o'clock. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Milt Hinton, whose name I've known for years as a bass player, but it was just this month that I learned that while Hinton traveled the country with his bass, he also carried with him a camera. And his photographs offer a glimpse of jazz musicians that you're not apt to find in the more official publicity shots taken for press kits and album jackets. Hinton photographs from the inside. The musicians are his friends and colleagues, and they don't need to pose in front of his camera. His first one-man show of photographs, now on exhibit at the Paul Kava Gallery, 1715 Spruce Street, includes a range of his photographs from about 1938 to 1976. One of those 1938 photos shows a very young Dizzy Gillespie mingling at a social occasion. Another 1938 shot features musicians from the Calloway Band, Chew Berry, Cozy Cole, Tyree Glenn, Danny Barker, posed ironically in front of the colored entrance to a hotel in Atlanta where they're waving and bowing and tipping their hats. There are two striking photographs of Billie Holiday in the show, both taken in 1958, shortly before her death. We see her looking up from the sheet music on her stand of But Not For Me, and in the second, also shot during a recording session, dressed in a wool plaid skirt, black sweater with a locket around her neck, she's staring into the ice of a nearly completed drink. Hinton's photographs are now valuable documents of their times, but they can also be appreciated for his fine eye for visual composition. He has more than 25,000 negatives in his collection, which he's recently started to catalog with the help of an NEA grant. Temple University sociologist Dave Berger, one of Hinton's former bass students, has been doing the cataloging. He also organized the Paul Kava show and is writing a book with Hinton about his life. Milt Hinton was born in Mississippi in 1910 and moved to Chicago at the age of 11. During the 20s and 30s, he played the Chicago clubs, working with musicians like Erskine Tate, Art Tatum, and Zooty Singleton. He spent the period from 1936 to the mid-50s in the Cab Calloway Band. He then became a constantly in-demand studio musician, recording sessions for people as diverse as Aretha Franklin, Percy Faith, Andre Castellanos, and Barbra Streisand. He played in the band for the Honeymooners and spent some time recording and touring with Jackie Gleason. During all of this, he continued to record with many small jazz bands. Recently, he's been with the Dick Cavett Show Band. He was the house bass player at Michael's Pub, and he continues to travel and play many of the American and European jazz festivals. And his show of photographs, again, is on display at the Paul Kava Gallery at 1715 Spruce Street. Milt Hinton, it's so nice to meet you, and I want to say from the start how much I enjoy your music and your photographs, and it was a great surprise to find those photographs.
Thank you very much. It's nice being here with you.
This is your first one-man show. Are you surprised that the photographs you've been taking throughout your life have become as important documents of our time as they are now?
I'm just amazed. I'm delighted, but I'm simply amazed, because when I was taking them, it was a period of seeing certain things and wanting to record it, but not thinking that it was 30 or 40 years or 25 years from the day that they would be such milestones. But time brings on these great changes.
Most of the photographs that I can think of jazz musicians are done either by photojournalists for newspapers or by people doing photographs for publicity kits or record album jacket covers. But your photographs are really done from the inside, because they're all your friends and your fellow performers.
Right. I was only thinking of seeing us the way we see ourselves. Example, I would, on the bus, a guy was taking a nap. He was sleeping and relaxing, getting ready to get to the next town. in a recording studio listening to a playback. Sometimes we couldn't have a photographer in there, professional photographer, because they couldn't have any distraction from the music or somebody looking around while we were playing. But during the playback, when the musician were relaxing and listening, you get some very intense moments and you get some very beautiful pictures, like the ones of Billie Holiday listening to what she's just recorded back, and the impression, the feeling that I wish I had done that better and I hope I get another chance. These are important. These are things that I don't think people from the outside see of us, how we feel.
Are outside photographers ever allowed into a recording session?
Well, they are, sure. Sometimes for great media, especially if you're a star now, they want pictures for magazines, they would be. But again, there's a presence. The minute you see a photographer in there, everybody gets on. You start sprucing up, well, somebody's here. This is being recorded. But when I'm there, there's nothing. It's just another guy with a camera, you know. And if we might clown or something, hey, Milt, take this picture. Some guy might be clowning with Tony Bennett if it's a Tony Bennett date, and he might be pulling Tony's ear, say, Milt, get this. And of course, Tony wouldn't resent this because it's just for us, you see.
Were you considered to be a kook for carrying around a camera all the time?
No, not really. Quite a number of us, I guess, did. I just liked it. It was something to sort of entertain myself with in traveling. And at that time, it was an August camera company that was introducing a camera on the market, a C3 camera for $25. And that was like a third of my week's salary, so I invested in it, and it was quite a delight. It was a 35-millimeter camera, which means I could get 36 pictures on one roll of film. It's kind of cheap and lasting. So I could, and it was easy to carry sticks across my shoulder. It gave me a sense of a hobby that you can travel with. You know, people have hobbies, but you have to stay in one place in order to do them. With a camera, I can move around, and then when I get someplace, I can either work up to get a dark room, or else I can take it to the store and have it developed. But I threw all of these things. I looked at them, and perhaps I made one print of it, and I threw the negatives in boxes in the house, and my wife stored them in the basement until a fine young man like David Berger comes along studying with me, and he began to peek through all of these things and see them, and he realized the value of them, and he would bring his file, and he would tell me, now, who is this guy? And he would make he filed it, because I'm very disorganized, and David would file it, and I would tell him exactly who was on such and such a picture, and he would put it in order, and he began to get the dream about doing something with it and about doing something about my life, since I was lucky enough to have lived so long and played with so many different people. He thought that maybe someday somebody might be interested in hearing about some of the experiences and looking at some of the pictures.
Let's talk about some of the specific pictures in the show. There's one picture where a few of the musicians from the Calloway Band are posed in front of the colored-only entrance of an Atlanta hotel. And there's another photograph where two musicians are underneath a luncheonette sign that says colored-only.
Restaurant for colored-only. Well, there wasn't a great deal of sorrow for us with this. We recognized that we were in the South, and that was the rule of the South at that time. So we obeyed all of the rules, whatever the rules were. They were separate entrance for black and separate entrances for white. But we were sort of chagrined. We were sort of chic about this. And we said, hey, look at this sign. We New Yorkers. Dig this sign. Come on, guy. Get your picture taken under here. And we took a picture of it, not thinking that perhaps there are generations of young people today, which I'm happy to say, that never even known that that sort of thing existed.
So you took those pictures with some sense of irony.
Yes.
And you felt a little detached from that kind of segregation,
yes,
having come from,
yes,
the North.
Yes, coming from the North. But then now when I show them to some of my students, they're amazed that it really happened.
Did you and the other musicians ever figure out ways around observing those segregation rules?
Cab Calloway did his very best to do it, because we wanted to travel the South because it was a lot of money. It was very lucrative. He could get good engagements down there. But to go through the laws of segregation, of staying in separate hotels and eating in separate restaurants, he just padded his expense account, and he got a Pullman coach. And we would travel by train. And there wasn't any travel by plane in those days. And he would have a whole Pullman coach for his band and a baggage car for our equipment. And he even had a baggage car big enough to put one of his automobiles in because he was doing very well, and he had a chauffeur and a Lincoln car in the baggage. So we would travel to a town like Atlanta, Georgia, and his chauffeur would pull his limousine out of the baggage car, and we would dress immaculate in our clothes from our Pullman into the baggage car. And when we stepped off the train, it was like out of a bandbox. And we had kept the same Pullman porter for 6 months. We would go to the dance, play the dance, and rather than go to segregated restaurants and eat, we would tell a porter, go out and get us 50 chicken sandwiches and 2 cases of beer and 5 watermelon and have it iced up and cold when the dance is over. We would come back to the Pullman, have a party, if we so choose to invite some ladies from the local territory to come back and share it with us, we would do that. And we would have our own private party on the Pullman car, and everybody would leave, and then when the train came along the next morning, hooked on, and we went to the next town.
Were there any ever any times when the lives of the band were endangered, either by Klan or racists?
Oh, yes, many times, yeah. Not by Klans, but that we knew as Klans, but by racist people that we would play the South in places where people were poor and had suddenly become rich because oil had been discovered on their property. And these people were very poor, and they didn't know how to handle money. And all of a sudden, some big company comes along and give them a few $1,000 a month just to drill on their company, on their land. And they wanted everything. They said, well, bring those boys from New York down and entertain us. And we would get out there to entertain them. And entertainment for them was considered throwing a few beer bottles at our heads. There was a law in one particular place where if you hit a black man in the mouth or hit him, you could pay a $300 fine. Well, this didn't deter him since he had money. So now he's willing to pay $300 just to hit a guy. And
how'd you get out of that?
Well, we'd had managers that came with us, and he knew that if he let us get hurt, it would be not good business for him, and we wouldn't come back again. So he would do whatever he could to sort of call an intermission, the same as stopping the fight. He'd call an intermission, take the band off the bandstand, put us in a basement or in some back room, and let the people get to drinking until they drank and fought amongst themselves. If they didn't see us, they'd wind up drinking and fighting amongst themselves until they'd fought themselves out and went home, and then they would call us out and put us in a car or something and take us back to our Pullman. This has happened many times, and we would be frightened about it, and we later laughed about it later, but it was all part of the game at that time.
Let's get to another photograph.
Sure, sure.
There's a photograph from, I think it's the early 1950s, where Louis Armstrong is seated, and I think there's some drums on the left, and on his right is a stack of about 3 pieces of recording and playback
equipment. Yeah, tape
recorders,
yeah. Well, Louis loved, he slept very little. That picture's of 1953, 54, that picture's from that era. We just come back from Japan, and Louis slept very little. Every night, wherever he was home. He was very satisfied. Any hotel room, all reservations were made for him. He had a suite of rooms. He had a band board. Everything was taken care of him by his office and his manager, Joe Glazer, so that he was very comfortable. When he got off, he could go to his room, sit down, and have whatever he chose to have. Every night he ate Chinese food. Every night he ate Chinese food, had whetted his appetite with whatever he felt would make him feel a little happy. And then he would order a big Chinese meal and drink one bottle of beer. Then he would lay back and go to sleep. He wouldn't really be asleep. And this band boy had to keep this tape recorder going. And he had 3 tape recorders. The one on the top is going, and it's playing only his records, the records that he'd made, the thousands that he'd made down through the years. And he would play these until that ran out. And when it ran out, if it stopped, he would wake right up. He'd give a little snort and wake up, and the boy would start the second tape recorder and continue. He only listened to his music and Guy Lombardo's. That's all he ever wanted on there. And this went on all night, and this is the way he sort of got his rest. So that was the still of that picture in his room to show how he traveled with a deck of tape recorders, 3.
I'm surprised by that. He liked Guy Lombardo so much.
He was very, very fond of Guy, and they were very good friends.
He liked that sweet sound?
He liked the sweet sound of Guy Lombardo's band. It was one of his favorite bands.
There's a photograph of Jimmy Blanton with 2 other musicians, the young bass player for the Ellington Band. And he's wearing the pants, really baggy pants, to a zoot suit with suspenders on and a white brimmed hat. And he looks really dwarfed by the clothes that he's wearing, and he looks so young.
Well, Jimmy was only 22 when he died. That picture, he must have been about 20, years old, I guess, when that picture was taken. And that was his dress of the day, the wide hat, like almost like the cowboy thing today, the wide hat, the big baggy pants with the waistline coming way up of your chest, about 6 inches above your navel, really, and the suspenders and the wide hat. And that was taken at 126th and 8th Avenue in dead center Harlem, one block or less than a half a block from the Apollo Theater backstage in front of the Braddock Hotel, which was where all the black musicians stayed that were traveling, because you kept you right near the center of things. And that was with Duke, and he had come in. And the guy on the right is Scovel Brown, which is a saxophone player, and the guy on the left is another bass player, Al Lucas, which had come to say hello to Jimmy because he was really the king and had revolutionized bass playing. So we were all there to see him and greet him and say hello to him. He was a very, very friendly, warm person. And I was lucky enough to have my camera, and I said, "Hey, baby, let's take a picture." Right now, my wife is always after me because there's so many pictures that I took that I'm never on them because I was always taking her pictures. And now she travels with me, and she's always saying, "Hey, you better get in one of these pictures."
There was no way you could have known when you were taking that photograph of Blanton that he would die at the age of 22. What do you think of when you look back at that photo now?
Well, I look sadly when he was 20, and I was with him when he died in 22 in California. And it was sad and ironical that he died of tuberculosis at 22. He didn't drink or smoke. It was no matter of dissipation. He was not that kind of a young man. He was just impeccably clean living and dedicated to music. But he had come from Tennessee, from St. Louis, to Duke's band, and he, being very young and very frail, he weighed maybe less than 110 pounds, playing all that fabulous bass. But he got in his band, which was traveling by bus, and you play a dance, and you get soaking wet, and you get in the bus soaking wet and ride to the next town, and your clothes dry on you, and he caught cold. And by the time he got to California, he had contracted tuberculosis. And here he was at the top of his career, the peak of his career, and he's got tuberculosis, and the doctors examined him and told him that he'd have to quit. And Duke Ellington put him in a rest home in California because they were playing a million-dollar ballroom there. And the reason I know it because Duke's band was leaving and Cab Calloway's band was opening the next night. And Ben Webster, which was Jimmy Blanton's friend, said to me, they called Blanton Bear. He says, "Bear's over there and he's sick. Be sure and look out to him. The band is leaving, but you're going to be here." And I think that broke Blanton's heart to see that Duke Ellington band leave him in California. He had never been out that way much before, and he was so very far from home and with tuberculosis. And he had a lovely place, a rest home, but just to be alone. And we had no sulfur drugs or penicillin in those days all they did for tuberculosis was just put you in a room and let you try, hope you would get well. And I think with a broken heart and the band leaving and his feeling that his future had just passed, I think he died of broken heart from that because I was there every other day to see him. I even took one of my Christian Science friends in the hope of anything we could save, and we tried to pray, but it was just past time. And at 22, he was gone.
Yeah. Do you ever get self-conscious about things like that and say, "Well, gosh, I mean, he's near death. I should take a lot of photographs because the person won't be around much longer"?
No, I never thought of anything like that. I never thought. In fact, I don't think I would ever take a picture under those circumstances if I thought this was going to be the end. I would never go near an accident with my camera to take a picture of someone in an accident. That type of tough photography never entered my mind. It's just to record something that I thought was happiness or something unusual, but never from that standpoint would I use my camera.
Let's talk about some more of the photographs. You've got two incredibly striking photographs of Billie Holiday at what ended up being her last recording session,
yes,
a session that you were featured on. Do you want to describe the photographs and tell us about the circumstances?
Well, the circumstances were we had done one date and it didn't turn out too well, and I guess the powers that be knew that Billie was going to go, and I think she had some sort of feeling that her career was near the end, and her dear friend Lester Young Prez had died, and she didn't feel too good about that, and she was in sort of disarray in her health. So then she could use the bread, and they asked her to do this album, and she really asked for a certain musician, the the arranger, the conductor of the date was Ray Ellis, and we worked for him. And by the way, this is the man that wrote the theme song for the Today Show, which is on one of the networks. And Ray, she asked him, said, well, look, get Hank. Well, Hank is Hank Jones, piano. She said, get Sweets. Sweets is Harry Anderson, great trumpet player. She said, get Melt, that's me. And she said, get Joe Wilder. And she called different guys' names that she had previous association with, and I guess she wanted to figure if we were all there, and it would always be a big laugh, because Harry Anderson Sweets is a great comic on a record. He has a stage. No matter how the record goes, when it's over, he always says, you ain't gonna get nothing no better than that. And it kind of makes you feel good. So to have these kind of people around, the happiness, I figured she figured would make it good. And so we were there. We were delighted to be there. But she came in and they bought some vodka for her to drink because she felt she needed a little support. But as she sat there, you could see that her ankles were swollen, that she had the fluid there. And she was in bad shape. And we took our time. And the conductor was very kind to her. And we played the music. The band is marvelous, but her voice was just not there anymore. And we listened to the playback. Well, then the jokes started being passed around, and that's when I got my camera out now, and we're going to go around. We took pictures, and I go over, and she's listening to a playback, and I take a picture of her, not thinking that this is really the last. I'd never thought of it in that time. This is the last time I'll ever photograph her. She's sitting there like I had so many other times on dates taking pictures of her. She's got the glass in her hand, and she's not looking like she is pretty she used to look, because time is caught up. But then you can see, and looking at them again, you can see that she's dissatisfied with her work, and she's sort of biting one lip on one of the pictures. She's biting the side of her mouth, and you can see tears in her eyes, knowing it. Under other circumstances and at other times, this would be so much better. She's perhaps thinking and wishing, I wish I'd better do this again. Maybe I can do it better. And those are the kind of things that show up in that picture.
What were you thinking as the bass player for the date when you heard her sing? Since her voice is so, her phrasing is still as always wonderful, but her voice is so thick and distorted.
Yeah, and it was cracking. We're just hoping, we just keep hoping. It's like a good athlete. You hope he's going to make a touchdown. I said, gee, I hope she can do the next one. Maybe if we do two or three takes, maybe she'll get one through. And I have been on record dates with her when she walked in 40 minutes late and did four tunes and walked out a half hour ahead of time, because she was so together, she was so sharp, and she was so together that she knew we'd come in and practice and rehearse the music and get our part down. And she still hadn't shown up for the date. And she would come in with her big dog, sheepdog, and looking very pretty. And she'd come in and say hello to everybody and say, what we got here today? And we would play it in two takes or one take, and she was gone. So we were hoping that, hey, maybe not in the second take, maybe the third take she would get it. You know, and when the date was over, we knew that it was over. And then on retrospect, when I looked at the pictures after developing and I saw what was happening, you could almost see the shadow of death, the shadow behind her, that it was like the end. But this was all looking after it.
Maybe we could take a pause from our conversation for a minute and play one of the earlier sessions that you recorded with Billie Holiday.
Sure, I'd like to hear that.
We're going to be hearing More Than You Know. Do you remember recording it?
Yes, I do. I remember that's one of my favorite records with her, with Teddy Wilson.
Can you tell us a little bit about the session?
I think Ben Carter's on there, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ben Carter's on that session. I was with Cab Calloway's band at the time, and Teddy Wilson was with Benny Goodman's band at the time. And we were in the Cotton Club, and Benny was in the Pennsylvania Hotel. So whenever Teddy would record, we'd been friends from Chicago before he came to New York. So now that I'm with Cab Calloway and he's with Benny Goodman, we're only too happy. Anytime that I'm in town and Teddy has a record date, he's going to use me on it. And I'm very grateful, because our intermissions were at the same time, and we were off in the daytime and worked at night in the club. So Teddy would use me. If I was out of town and Teddy was in town and he was going to make a record session, he would perhaps call John Kirby, which was a very famous bass player. So consequently, you see these different personnel on the different records. If I was Cab Calloway was in town and Ben Webster was in town, then Milt Hinton and Ben Webster would be on the date. And Cozy Cole, which was the drummer in the Cab Calloway band, because we were all buddies. Now, if we were out, then perhaps Gene Krupa would be there because he was already working with Teddy. So this is how the different personnel was sort of brought about. This date happened to be a time when I was in town, and Benny Carter was in town, and Teddy was there, and he said he had this contract to do the record coming. And Lionel Hampton was also with Benny Goodman, and later he would record for RCA. And Lionel and I went to school together in Chicago. So when Lionel had a record date, if I was in town, he would graciously give me a shot at it, and you can check some of those out, some of the old One Sweet Letter from you, some of the old Hampton dates. So this is how that record session became More Than You Know. I don't remember much more about it. I think Alan Roos was a guitar player on that date. I don't remember now, but Benny Carter was on that, I'm sure.
Benny Carter and Ernie Powell, Danny Barker
guitars. He lives in New Orleans now. Great historian, great jazz historian. Fabulous. He wrote a great book called Bourbon Street Black that's just marvelous.
Well, let's hear this recording of More Than You Know, and it was made in 1939, and my guest Milt Hinton is featured on bass.
More than you know, more than you know, man of my heart, I love you so. Lately I find you on my mind, more than you know. Whether you're right, whether you're wrong, man of my heart, I'll string along. So more than you'll ever know, loving you the way that I do, there's nothing I can do about it. Loving may be all you can give, but darling, I can't live without it. Oh, how I'll cry, how I'd sigh if you got tired and said goodbye. More than I'd show, more than you'll ever know.
Billie Holiday with Teddy Wilson's band, and my guest Milt Hinton featured on bass, as recorded in 1939. And the occasion for Milt Hinton's visit to Philadelphia today is his one-man show of photographs that's now on exhibit at the Paul Cava Gallery, which is at 1715 Spruce Street. And it's an incredible show of photographs from 1938 to 1976 of jazz musicians. And since these musicians are all the people who Milt Hinton was playing with, they're not putting on any special poses for the photographer. You get to see musicians in a way that you don't ordinarily see them. You moved to Chicago from Mississippi in the 1920s.
No, 1917 or 18.
Oh, well,
yeah.
When you were playing the clubs in Chicago in the 20s and in the 30s, I think a lot of the clubs were owned by the mob then, right?
Yeah, well, Chicago was a hotbed of jazz from right after the First World War. Blacks were migrating from the South because they found that it was a better way to make a living, and Chicago was the mecca. Chicago was the center of the United States around that time. Remember, there are no planes now. Or trains come, the 20th century came from New York to Chicago, and you changed and took the Santa Fe train to go to California. So Chicago being the center, all conventions were held there. All salesmen, everything came. The great fabulous hotels were there, the Palmer House, the Cottage Inn, the great bands, Black and White, Ben Burney, all of the great bands played there. Ben Pollard, the Grand Terrace Cafe, the Sunset Cafe. Louis Armstrong came up from New Orleans. All this great entourage of great musicians from New Orleans are coming to Chicago. All black labor, unskilled labor is making it because you got the biggest stockyards in the world there that need unskilled black labor. And you can make $15, $25, $30 a week and come home with all of the food you want besides. And so we had this great migration of people coming in. Entertainment is there. People got money to spend. The salesmen are there. When they're salesmen, there's going to be good business for hotels and good prostitution and good gangsters that could come in. Bootleg booze was in. Booze became popular. The black guy could make a great deal of money as a bell captain. My uncle, which was the first one in 1910 to migrate from Mississippi, told me how he came, and he could make $25 or $30 a day, which was unheard of, because he would get to be he was a porter, and when a salesman checks into a hotel, porter takes him to his room, and the first thing a salesman wants to know is, you get me a good girl. And there's a good girl in the hotel that says to the porter, you get me a good John, I gave you a tip. So he gets a tip from both ends of it, and when they both get together, what do they need? Some booze, which he had just made in the basement. He goes downstairs and he sells them a pint of bootleg booze for $5, which he made for 50 cents. So he's made $6, $8 on the one deal. And this was a kind of thing of flowing. And then the mob gangs can come in. Al Capone opened up a cotton club in Cicero, which was his whole community, and he hired black entertainment patterned after this New York Cotton Club, and he got a band, Walter Bond's band, to play. So there was labor, there was work, and there was entertainment and hilarity and murders, and St. Valentin Day murders, and a growing city, and people are really enjoying it. You got a great man here that's playing here on One More Time, Jabbo Smith, that I worked with in the early 30s in Chicago, and one of my first engagements was with the very great Jabbo Smith.
Did you did the mob's control of a lot of the clubs affect you in any way? Did they control the music you had to play or make any requests or anything?
They were great. They were great for entertainment. They loved entertainment, and they were crude and rough. I remember Al Capone was known to be a very, very rough guy, but he liked certain tunes. And the minute he came to get through the door, the band would start playing that tune. Before he left, he'd send $300 of that to him. If he was angry about something, he might kick a porter, but on his way out, he'd give him $50. So the guy felt that if the little bruise didn't bother him too much, he'd picked up a $50 bill. So there wasn't much, nobody told us what to play, just play some good music and have some good dancing and let me have a good time. The gangsters took control, and they fought for control of different territories, but we had nothing to do with that. If there was a shootout, everybody ducked under the piano and hoped to get out the way because they really weren't shooting at the musician.
Do you remember what Capone's favorite tune was?
No, I don't. I remember George Ralph had a favorite tune, Sweet Georgia Brown, and every time George Ralph, which had quite a great deal of association with some of the bigger people. Anytime George Raff came in, he was sort of a dancer. He liked to dance. And anytime we saw George Raff hit the door while we were in a cotton club in New York, we'd play Sweet Georgia Brown. And sometime before the night was over, even the gangsters, all these guys that knew him and loved him, he would get up on the stage and do his little his little turn to the band, and of course it was worth $100 to us.
You joined the Calloway Band in the mid-1930s.
Yeah, 1936, 1935.
How did he find out about you? Did he audition you?
No, not at all. That's an interesting story if you get them on. Getting back to Teddy Wilson, which you just played, Teddy Wilson and Kay Johnson, a bunch of us were all friends working, gigging, as we call it, around Chicago, making a fair decent living, $5, $6 a night. And John Hammond, a great jazz impresario, heard Teddy Wilson, went to New York and told Ben and Carter, says there's a fine piano player in Chicago, send for him. So Ben and Carter sent for Teddy Wilson. Made us feel very good, but we felt lonely. Nobody sent for me. This is 1933 or 32. He goes to New York, and he gets to play with Benny Carter, and he gets around, and Benny Carter needs a trombone player, so he sends for my other friend, Kay Johnson, and they send for Kay. Now it leaves me pretty lonely, and I'm embarrassed that nobody sent for me. So 1933, Kay Johnson comes to New York, and later he gets with Cab Calloway's band, and they go to California in 1935 to make a picture with Al Jolson called The Singing Kid. And during the making of this picture, the bass player at Cab Calloway, Al Morgan, was just a fabulous bass player, good-looking guy and very photogenic, and the cameras just went crazy. And Cab, in the making of this movie, he would be dancing, and he'd look around thinking the cameras were on him, and it would be on his bass player. And it didn't sit too very good with Cab, and they sort of had a few altercations about that, and a few bad words were passed. And finally, the director said to this bass player one day, Al Morgan, said, "Hey, man, you're so great. If you were in California, every time we did a picture with a jazz band in it, we would use you." So this guy quit and stayed in California, and Cab's band was due back east. So Cab was distraught, and he asked the guy, said, "Look, I got to get a bass player." Now my friend Kay Johnson says, "Hey, I got a friend in Chicago, Milt Hinton. We got to go through Chicago to get to New York. Stop and hear him. He's playing at the Three Deuces with Zooty Singleton's band, and Art Tatum is a relief piano player. So why don't you stop by and see him?" So Cap stops by in his coonskin coat and his derby, and the crowd all roared when he walked in. And he never said a word to me. Went over to Zooty Singleton, the great drummer, and said, "I hear the kid's pretty good on bass." And Zooty said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'd like to have him. Can I have him?" And Zooty said, "Yeah, you can have him." So Zooty come to me and said, "Kid, you're gone." I said, "I'm going away." He said, "Cab just asked me for you." I said, "Well, don't I have to give you a notice or something?" He said, "You better get out of here." And so that night, Cab got through. He never said one word to me. He came up, the people applauded him. He came up and hired a hold of song. And he looked back at me casually and said, "The train leaves tomorrow from the South Street Station at 9 o'clock. Be there." And that's how I got the job. And when I got there, my friend Kay Johnson was there. I was making $35 a week in this club in Three Deuces, and it was the best job in Chicago in 1935.
Is there anything like an initiation process when you join a band like the Calloway Band where the other musicians test you out and see if you're worthy?
Oh, yeah. You go through that quite a bit. This was a fabulous band. All of these truly great musicians, the great Ben Webster, Doc Cheatham, Miles Randolph, all these great names, Claude Jones, Leroy Maxey, great drummers, and Benny Payne, great pianists. And Ben Webster was the one that really put me to the blood test because he was fabulous, and he walked in and he'd been about three shades in the wind, and he looked, and I was weighing about 110 pounds soaking wet, had this one little bi-swing gabardine suit and a canvas bag, which my mother put a change of underwear in for me. And Ben Webster walked on the train and says, "What is this?" And the fellow said, "This is a new bass player." And he said, "A new what?" You know, and I felt like going through the floor. And naturally, everybody stayed away from me. And when the train stopped at the next station, everybody go to find rooms. And we didn't go to hotels in those days. Everybody had written ahead to some lady's home to put them up for the night. And I didn't know anybody. So by the time I got off the train with my bass, the whole band had disappeared. And I didn't have any place to stay. And it was just terrible. And I finally asked the cab driver to take me where he took the rest of the musician. And when I got there, they were all sitting down eating. And they had to sit there. And they said, "There's no more room here. That's all." And shut the door. And the guy took me to another place, and the straw boss of the band, Walter Thomas, which was the assistant leader, and the first trumpet player, Lamar Wright, which were the biggies in the band, they were at a separate house. Miss Jones had a separate place for them, and she had a table set with the chicken and the potato pie and everything. And I opened the door, and this lady looked in there, I stood, and he says, go down the street, the musician all down the street. I said, they wouldn't let me in. They say it was no place. So they took pity on me. Said, well, if they would let me, Miss Jones gave him a room. And they kept me with them, which gave me my security. And to this very day, one of them is still living. Walter Thomas is one of my dearest friends.
There's a photograph in your show of the Calloway band dressed in baseball uniforms, and it says Calloway on it. Did the band have a team?
Oh, yeah. We had a baseball team. We had a basketball team. Cab was very athletic in his young days, and he liked to be a very strong guy. He's from Baltimore, and he's a racehorse man and a street fighter. I mean, he really knows how to move. He can get around and very well protect himself. So he loved sports, and he organized a baseball team, and we played one another. We played Woody Herman's band. All the bands had baseball teams during that era. And we would meet in Central Park or in Los Angeles, whatever two bands were in town, and we would play one another. And Cab with money, he bought uniforms for us. And he made Tyree Glenn the manager of the team. And Cab was playing on the team. And he wasn't too good a player really at his position. And Tyree put him off the team, pulled him off, and Cab sold the team for a penny. He sold the team to one of the other to a catcher and Dupree Wheeler. And he wouldn't have anything to do with the team because Tyree pulled him off of the team. But it was just that much of a tight thing. Tyree wouldn't take it back. He says, you didn't play well and you put him off.
I'm talking to Milt Hinton if you're just joining us. And I thought we could take another pause and listen to some more of your music.
Yeah.
And this is from an import album. It's called Basically With Blue. And it's an album that you led. And we're going to hear Back Home in Indiana, and you're going to be playing slap bass on it. Can you talk a little bit about how you play like this?
Yeah, well, that was the type of bass that was being played when I came in, when I was a youngster. This guy, Bill Johnson, that I mentioned in the first part of our interview, that I saw in Wellmanbro, there was a great bass player with Duke Ellington's band. These people were great bassists, but they've slapped. You pick one note and slap the second. One, pick, slap. Pick, slap, pick, slap, pick, slap. And it became quite popular. It gave a very rhythmic sound. And then, of course, some guys got a little fancy, you pick, slap, tap, then you find it's pick, slap, three, pick, slap, four, and that kind of thing, according to whatever your dexterity was like. Well, being a youngster, this thing was right down my alley. So I got to the place where I could just about do anything, slapping it and picking it and laying in the floor and doing all sorts of things. And I think I sort of disgusted everybody with it because in the period of a few years, it disappeared. Nobody did it. So today I'm practically the only left survivor of slap bass. But I'm finding that the young players, they look at me with such rarity and they flock to me to see how it's done. And I'm delighted to try to show them because I would like to see research recurring of it because it is a very phonogenic and a very visual thing.
Well, let's hear a 1976 recording, which is an example of this playing, and it's from the Milt Hinton album Basically With Blue.
Thank you.
Milt Hinton from his album Basically with Blue, and we heard Cliff Smalls at the piano, Sam Woodyard drums. And the occasion again for Milt Hinton's visit to Philadelphia today is his one-man show of photographs that are now on display at the Paul Cavett Gallery at 1715 Spruce Street. And I was telling him a little earlier that seeing some of his photographs made me want to see more. And there is a book that's being put together by Dave Berger, who is the Temple University sociologist that also organized the show. And that should be coming out eventually. I don't know exactly when, but there will be more photographs and stories in this book about Milt Hinton when it does come out. Jazz is a popular all over the world, and there's countries that might not be too fond of the United States necessarily, but that will really love jazz that comes out of this country. I know that you've toured the world probably a number of times, and you toured with Armstrong in about 51, 52 in Japan.
Yeah.
And that wasn't too long after two atom bombs were dropped by America on Japan, and I'm sure there was still quite a bit of bitterness when you were there.
Well, the Japanese people show very little facial expressions or expressions of dislike. You never know really what they're thinking. It's like what you say about Orientals and a poker face, you never really know. But it was sad for us to be there, and you did feel a sense of coldness because ruins were still there. They were rebuilding, and even as near as 53, they were still rebuilding. And we had bombed one of the biggest theaters they had there, the Kokusai Kicho, and we had bombed it, and they had rebuilt it, and we were one of the first American bands to play in there. And this is a huge theater that had, like our Radio City has 100 girls. They had 200 girls on the stage, and they had five restaurants in this theater. So we saw this, but there's always been that great enjoyment of American music, which they consider, like most other people, this is one of the only truly thing that's really American, that they can't say King had his derivative in some other country. So what we did find in there in Japan was that the great diversity of liking of different types of American bands, not necessarily always hardcore jazz. There was a Guy Lombardo band that was patterned exactly after Guy Lombardo with the two pianos. There was a Count Basie-type band. There was a Benny Goodman-type band. There was a Duke Ellington-type band. So the groups of Japanese people that, as we say, know about them or said... great copyists and innovators. They would take a band and copy exactly the notation to the nth degree and play only that type of music. And then, of course, now they've become more creative and they have their own groups of fabulous Japanese musicians because they've learned to play and they're even making very great musical instruments now and that sort of thing. But I find in traveling the world that music is an auditory art. People hear you. They don't see you. So you're judged by how you sound. And it sort of gets the color of your face. Recordings do that to us. It freezes. You've heard people say to you, hey, I heard such and such a band, a record of the band, and then I went to hear them there in the club, and they didn't sound the same. Well, it didn't sound the same because on a recording session, this leader would take his finest arrangements and he would pick the finest musician to play this arrangement. He didn't care what color they were because this is on wax. Nobody's going to see them. But he would pick the best musician according to the auditory art, you see. And then when you heard the band in person, he might have a certain ethnic group only in that particular band because everybody had been associated that this was that type of band. And when you heard it, you would notice a difference. I've had people say, I've did some of the very great recordings with Guy Lombardo's band, and there never was a black man in any of his bands. But when Guy made some records, he'd say, hey, Milt, I want you to play bass on this.
What's it like to record for a middle-of-the-road band like Guy Lombardo or Percy Faith?
Well, the music is a service. First, this is what students of music must learn. It's a service, and one does best what one does most. You have your druthers, but if you're going to make a living at it, you must deal in a service. I try to be able to know my instrument and be able to comply with whatever you choose. And when I walk on a record date, I'm just trying to see that you get the best shot at making a hit record. And I do everything I can to support you, and I play it the way you want me to play it. It might not be the way I would like to play it, but I'm going to do what you want. And then, as we say in our cliche, my name's not going to be on the album cover. Your name is going to be on there. So when I get ready to do my album, I'll do it my way. But if I want to make a living and record every day, I'll do your record and I'll try to make you sound good. And next week I'll do Barbara Streisand's. And next week I'll do Aretha Franklin's. And next week I'll do Sarah Vaughan's.
What are your favorite kinds of sessions to record?
They always jazz because there's the freedom of doing that. But there's a great sense of responsibility to play in a big orchestra and this concerted effort to be a portion of something and be very disciplined and do exactly, to be able to take commands from a good leader and for everybody to do a good job. I'm extremely proud of seeing that I did part of the track for The Wiz under Quincy Jones, which I think is a great composer and a great writer, and to have 77 men in that band with click tracks in your ear and a conductor and have everybody, all 77 guys, come down at once. And when it comes out, it's sheer happiness. This is like great teamwork, and there's always a joy in that.
I mentioned earlier that seeing some of your photographs made me really want to see more, and I'll look forward to being able to do that through the eventual publication of the book. But can you tell me about one or two photographs that I haven't seen yet in this show that you could describe?
Yes, there's one I think I mentioned off camera, off mic, about 75 years of jazz. And I mentioned it because in Chase, New York, July 4th, we're going to have a concert up there honoring Sonny Greer. And there's a picture that I happened to be at the 75 years of jazz taken some number of years ago where they had 75 or 100 musicians that had been recognized and people knew about. And they asked us like 10 or 12 o'clock in the day to come up and have a photo made. And the photographer was there, and he wanted us all to get up against a brownstone building so he could take a group picture, not really realizing, I happened to be there with my camera, not realizing that all of these beautiful people, they would never get together in any one given place ever in life except to be commanded to do so for a photo. And here you've got the water seeking his own level. Here, five drummers all happily talking to one another and just delighted to be here. There's Sonny Greer talking to Zooty Singleton, talking to Gene Krupa, talking to George Wetland, talking to just any number of, and I just happened to take this picture. They're completely ignoring this man and saying, please come get up here on the thing because they're so glad. And there's Mary Lou Williams talking to Marion McPartland, talking to Stuff Smith, you know, and there's Coleman Hawkins laughing with prayers with that big pork pie hat on, prayers, and Roy Eldridge is making faces at Dizzy. And I'm just going crazy taking these pictures as cameraman. And finally, the picture came out in Esquire magazine. There's one huge picture which everybody enjoys and I think is still selling of all of these musicians, but nobody has seen the ones that we have except David and his help Holly, which is doing the photographic work and printing. See all of these marvelous pictures of great faces like Pee Wee Russell and people that are long gone. There's Oscar Pettiford and Stuff Smith and Willie the Lion Smith and just a myriad of great, great people in sheer happiness, sheer ecstasy, just to see one another.
Well, I'm going to look forward to seeing this photograph someday. Milt Hinton, it's really been so much fun to talk with you, and you've told such interesting stories today, and I want to thank you for coming to Fresh Air and to tell you again how much I enjoy your music and how much I enjoyed your photographs.
Thank you. Keep this air fresh. It's beautiful.
Thanks. Milt Hinton is a bass player and a photographer, and many of us are just learning about the photography part of his work. And there is a one-man show, his very first, that's now on exhibit at the Paul Cava Gallery, and that's at 1715 Spruce Street. There are photographs of jazz musicians from 1938 to 1976, and there's some very exciting material in this show. Well, we're going to hear another session from one of Milt Hinton's albums, and this is also from an album session that he led, and the album's called Here Swings the Judge, and we'll hear him with Ben Webster. The piece is All the Things You Are. Ha 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 Was Milt Hinton and Ben Webster playing together from an album session led by Milt Hinton. And again, if you'd like to see his one-man show of photographs that's been organized by Dave Berger, it's now on display at the Paul Cava Gallery at 1715 Spruce Street in Center City, Philadelphia. It's 2.5 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. When portable, affordable video technology was developed in the late 60s, it allowed access to video production by people who were unaffiliated with television stations. And it enabled video production to have a life outside of broadcast television. My guest George Stoney is one of the fathers of the community television movement and continues to be one of the movement's guiding forces. In 1968, Stoney became the executive director of one of the pioneer access experiments. It was called the Challenge to Change program, and it was funded by the National Film Board of Canada. In 1971, he co-founded and directed the Alternate Media Center at NYU, which also pioneered the use of video technology for public access television and cable. He spent 1974 to 76 as the designer and co-director of the Boston Media Project, an attempt to apply video to problems of school integration. Since 1946, he's been a documentary filmmaker. His recent films include How the Myth Was Made, in which he returned in 1977 to Arran, the site of the famous Robert Flaherty documentary Man of Arran. Shepherd of Night Flock is a biography of Father Garcia Gensel, I hope I'm saying that right, of St. Peter's Lutheran Church in New York, who has been called the jazz priest. And he's also about to complete a 90-minute film about the Weavers' reunion. Stoney is a professor of film and television at NYU and the head of his own film company, which makes film and video for social change. One of his chief projects now is developing access to public access cable. And he's in Philadelphia to speak at a conference at Temple University on... cable and access to independent video producers. George Stoney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Can you explain the premise of community access television?
Yes, it presumes that people need to speak to each other, need to express their concerns through the most powerful and the most the means of communication which most people depend on now, and that with the port-a-pack they can do so. And I should say that while we've been working through the cable access channels, I only regard cable as a useful rehearsal grounds. I think eventually we need to have public access to all electronic media.
You, in the Challenge to Change program in Canada, had some very interesting uses of video, which is what you're talking about, using video to communicate to each other and to help understand and make